dust cloth that was gray with the years. All of the original furnishings were still in the house, and it had taken Brandon and Dennis and a soldier hand-picked by Pena 3 more days to make sure all the sharp things were removed. Then, at last, the dollhouse was delivered by 2 squire boys, who toiled up the 300 stairs with the heavy, awkward thing spiked to a board between them. Beeson followed closely behind, cursing and threatening terrible reprisals if they should drop it. Sweat rolled down the boys' faces in rivers, but they made no reply. When the door of Peter's prison opened and the dollhouse was brought in, Peter gasped with surprise, not just because the dollhouse was finally here, but because one of the 2 boys carrying it was Ben Stodd.
"Give not a sign,"
Ben's eyes flashed.
"Don't look at me too long,"
Peter's flashed back. After the advice he had given, Pena would have been stunned to see Ben here. He had forgotten that the logic of all the wise old men in the world cannot often stand against the logic of a boy's heart. If the boy's heart is large and kind and loyal, Ben Stodd's was all 3. It had been the easiest thing in the world to exchange places with one of the squires meant to carry the dollhouse to the top of the needle for a guilder. All the money Ben had in the world, as a matter of fact. Dennis had arranged it.
"Don't tell your father of this,"
Ben cautioned Dennis.
"Why not?"
Dennis had asked.
"I tell me old Da almost everything, don't you?"
"I did," Ben said, remembering how his father had forbidden him to mention Peter's name any more in the house. "But when boys grow up, I think that sometimes changes. However that may be, you mustn't tell him this, Dennis. He might tell Pena, and then I'd be in a hot pot on a high fire."
"All right,"
Dennis promised. It was a promise he kept. Dennis had been cruelly hurt when his master, whom he had loved, had been first accused and then convicted of murder. In the last few days, Ben had gone a long way toward filling the empty place in Dennis's heart.
"That's good,"
Ben said, and punched Dennis playfully on the shoulder.
"I only want to see him a minute and refresh my heart."
"He was your best friend, wasn't he?"
"Still is."
Dennis had stared at him, amazed.
"How can you claim a man who murdered his own father as your best friend?"
"Because I don't believe he did it," Ben said.
"Do you?"
To Ben's utter amazement, Dennis burst into wretched tears.
"All my heart says the same, and yet—"
"Listen to it, then," Ben said, and gave Dennis a large, rough hug. "And dry off your mug before someone sees you bawling like a kid."
"Put it in the other room," Peter said now, distressed at the slight tremble in his voice.
Beeson didn't notice. He was too busy cursing the 2 boys for their slowness, their stupidity, their very existence. They carried the dollhouse into the bedroom and set it down. The other boy, who had a very stupid face, dropped his end too quickly and too hard. There was the tiny sound of something breaking inside. Peter winced. Beeson cuffed the boy, but he smiled as he did it. It was the first good thing that had happened to him since these 2 lads had appeared with the accursed thing. The stupid boy stood up, wiping the side of his face, which was already starting to swell, and staring at Peter with frank wonder and fear, his mouth wide open. Ben remained on his knees a moment longer. There was a small rattan mat in front of the house's front door, what we would call a welcome mat, I suppose. For just a moment, Ben allowed his thumb to move over the top of this, and his eyes met Peter's.
"Now get out!" Beeson cried. "Get out, both of you! Go home and curse your mothers for ever bringing such slow, clumsy fools as yourselves into the world!"
The boys passed Peter, the loutish one shrinking away as if the prince might have a disease he could catch. Ben's eyes met Peter's once more, and Peter trembled at the love he saw in his old friend's gaze. Then they were gone.
"Well, you have it now, my good little princeling,"
Beeson said.
"What shall we be bringing you next? Little ruffly dresses? Silk underpants?"
Peter turned slowly and looked at Beeson. After a moment, Beeson dropped his eyes. There was something frightening in Peter's gaze, and Beeson was forced to remember again that, sissy or not, Peter had beaten him so badly that his ribs had ached for 2 days and he had had dizzy spells for a week.
"Well, it's your business," he muttered. "But now that you have it, I could find a table for you to put it on and a chair to sit in while you—"
He grimaced.
"Well, you play with it."
"And how much would this cost?"
"A mere 3 guilders, I should think."
"I have no money."
"Ah, but you know powerful people."
"No more. Peter said. I traded a favor for a favor, that's all.
Sit on the floor, then, and get chilblains on your arse and be damned to ya,
Beeson said and strode from the room. A little flood of guilders he had enjoyed since Peter came to the Needle had apparently dried up. It put Beeson in a foul mood for days. Peter waited until he had heard all the locks and bolts go rattling home before lifting the rattan mat Ben had rubbed with his thumb. Beneath he found a square of paper no larger than the stamp on a letter. Both sides had been written on, and there were no spaces between the words. The letters were tiny indeed. Peter had to squint to read them, and guessed that Ben must have made them with the aid of a magnifying glass.
Peter, destroy this after you have read it. I don't believe you did it. Others feel the same, I am sure. I am still your friend. I love you as I always did. Dennis does not believe it either. If I can ever help, get to me through Pena. Let your heart be steadfast.
As he read this, Peter's eyes filled with warm tears of gratitude. I think that real friendship always makes us feel such sweet gratitude, because the world almost always seems like a very hard desert, and the flowers that grow there seem to grow against such high odds.
Good old Ben,
he whispered over and over again. In the fullness of his heart, he couldn't think to say anything else.
Good old Ben. Good old Ben.
For the first time he began to think that his plan, wild and dangerous as it was, might have a chance of succeeding. Next he thought of the note. Ben had put his life on the line to write it. Ben was noble. Barely, but not royal, thus not immune from the headsman's axe. If Beeson or one of his jackals found this note, they would guess that one or the other of the boys who had brought the dollhouse must have written it. The loudish one looked as if he couldn't read even the large letters in a child's book, let alone write such tiny ones as these. So they would look for the other boy, and from there to the chopping block might be a short trip for good old Ben. He could think of only one sure way to get rid of it, and he didn't hesitate. He crumpled the little note up between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand and ate it. By now, I am sure you have guessed Peter's plan of escape, because you know a good deal more than Pena did when he read Peter's requests. But in any case, the time has come to tell you straight out. He planned to use linen threads to make a rope. The threads would come, of course, from the edges of the napkins. He would descend this rope to the ground and so escape. Some of you may be laughing very hard at this idea. Threads from napkins to escape a tower 300 feet high? You could be saying, either you were mad, storyteller, or Peter was. Nothing of the sort. Peter knew how high the Needle was, and he believed he must never be greedy about how many threads he took from each napkin. If he unraveled too much, someone might become very curious. It didn't have to be the chief warder. The laundress who washed the napkins might be the one to notice rather a lot of each one was gone. She might mention it to a friend, who could mention it to another friend, and so the story would spread. And it wasn't really Beeson Peter was worried about, you know. Beeson was, all things said, a fairly stupid fellow. Flag was not. Flag had murdered his father, and Flag kept his ear to the ground. It was a shame Peter never stopped to wonder about that vague smell of must about the napkins, or to ask if the person hired to remove the royal crests had been let go after removing a certain number, or if that person was still at work, but of course his mind was on other things. He could not help noticing that they were very old, and this was certainly a good thing. He was able to take a great many more threads from each than he ever would have guessed in even his most optimistic moments. How many more than that he could have taken, he came to know only in time. Still, I can hear some of you saying, threads from napkins to make a rope long enough to reach from the window of the Needle's topmost cell to the courtyard? Threads from napkins to make a rope strong enough to support 170 pounds? I still think you are joking. Those of you who think so are forgetting the dollhouse. And the loom within, a loom so tiny that the threads of napkins were perfect for its tiny shuttle. Those of you who think so are forgetting that everything in the dollhouse was tiny, but worked perfectly. The sharp things had been removed, and that included the loom's cutting blade, but otherwise it was intact. It was the dollhouse about which Flag had had vague misgivings so long ago, which was now Peter's only real hope of escape. 71. I would have to be a much better storyteller than I am, I think, to tell you how it was for Peter during the 5 years he spent at the top of the needle. He ate, he slept, he looked out the window, which gave him a view to the west of the city. He exercised morning, noon, and evening. He dreamed his dreams of freedom. In the summer his apartment sweltered. In the winter it froze. During the second winter he caught a bad case of the grip, which almost killed him. Peter lay feverish and coughing under the thin blanket on his bed. At first he was only afraid he would lapse into delirium and rave about the rope that was hidden in a neat coil under two of the stone blocks on the east side of his bedroom. As his fever grew worse, the rope he had woven with the tiny dollhouse loom came to seem less important because he began to think he would die. Beeson and his lesser warders were convinced of it. They had, in fact, begun to wager on when it would happen. One night, about a week after the onset of his fever, while the wind raged blackly outside and the temperature dropped down to zero, Roland appeared to Peter in a dream. Peter was convinced that Roland had come to take him to the far fields. "I'm ready, Da," he cried. In his delirium, he didn't know if he had spoken aloud or only in his mind. "I'm ready to go." "You'll not be dying yet," his father said in this dream, or vision, or whatever it was. "You've much to do, Peter."
"Father!"
Peter shrieked. His voice was powerful, and below him the warders, Beeson included, quailed, thinking that Peter must be seeing the smoking, murdered ghost of King Roland come to take Peter's soul to hell. They made no more wagers that night, and in fact one of them went to the Church of the Great Gods the very next day and embraced his religion again and eventually became a priest. This man's name was Curran, and I may tell you of him in another story. Peter really was seeing a ghost in a way, although whether it was the actual shade of his father or only a ghost born in his fever-struck brain, I cannot say. His voice lapsed into a mutter. The warders did not hear the rest. "It's so cold, and I am so hot." "My poor boy," his glimmering father said. "You've had hard trials, and there are more of them ahead, I think. But Dennis will know."
"Now what?" Peter gasped. His cheeks were red, but his forehead was as pale as a wax candle.
"Dennis will know where the sleepwalker goes,"
his father whispered and was gone. Peter lapsed into a faint that quickly became a deep, sound sleep. In that sleep, his fever broke. The boy who had made it his practice over the last year to do 60 push-ups and 100 sit-ups each day awoke the next morning too weak to even get out of bed. But he was lucid again. Beeson and the lesser warders were disappointed. But after that night, they always treated Peter with a kind of awe and took care never to go too close to him, which, of course, made his job that much easier. All that is an easy enough tale to tell, though it would no doubt be better if I could say for sure that the ghost was there or that it was not. But like other matters in the larger tale, you'll have to make up your own mind about it, I suppose. But how am I to tell you about Peter's endless drudging work at that tiny loom? That tale is beyond me. All the hours spent, sometimes with frosty breath pluming from his mouth and nose, sometimes with sweat running down his face, always in fear of discovery, all those long hours alone, with nothing but long thoughts and almost absurd hopes to fill them. I can tell you some things, and will, but to convey such hours and days of slow time is impossible for me, and might be impossible for anyone except one of the great storytellers whose race is long vanished. Perhaps the only thing that even vaguely suggests how much time Peter spent in those two rooms was his beard. When he came in, it was only a shadow on his cheeks and a smudge under his nose, a boy's beard. In the 1,825 days which followed, it grew long and luxuriant. By the end it reached the middle of his chest, and although he was only 21, it was shot with gray. The only place it did not grow was along the length of the jagged scar left by Beeson's thumbnail. Peter dared pluck only 5 threads from each napkin the first year, 15 threads each day. He kept them under his mattress, and at the end of each week he had 105. In our measure, each thread was about 20 inches long. He wove the first batch a week after he received the dollhouse, working carefully with the loom. Using it was not as easy at 17 as it had been at 5.
His fingers had grown. The loom had not. Also, he was horribly nervous. If one of the warders caught him at his work, he could tell them he was using the loom to weave errant threads from the old napkins for his own amusement. If they believed it, and if the loom worked, he wasn't sure that it would until he saw the first slim cable, perfectly woven, emerging from the loom's far end. When Peter saw this, his nervousness abated somewhat, and he was able to weave a little faster, feeding the threads in, tugging them to keep them straight, operating the foot pedal with his thumb. The loom squeaked a little at first, but the old grease soon limbered up, and it ran as perfectly as it had in his childhood. But the cable was terribly thin, not even a quarter of an inch through the center. Peter tied off the ends and tugged experimentally. It held. He was a little encouraged. It was stronger than it looked, and he thought it should be strong. They were royal napkins, after all, woven from the finest cotton thread in the land, and he had woven tightly. He pulled harder, trying to guess how many pounds of strain he was putting on the slim cotton cable. He pulled even harder. The rope still held, and he felt more hope come stealing into his heart. He found himself thinking about Yosef. It had been Yosef, head of the stables, who told him about that mysterious and terrible thing called breaking strain. It was high summer, and they had been watching huge Anduin oxen pull stone blocks for the plaza of the new market. A sweating, cursing drover sat astride each ox's neck. Peter had then been no more than 11, and he thought it better than a circus. Yosef pointed out that each ox wore a heavy leather harness. The chains that pulled the dressed blocks of stone were attached to the harness, one on each side of the animal's neck. Yosef told him the cutters had to make a careful estimate of just how much each block of stone weighed. "Because if the blocks are too heavy, the oxen might hurt themselves trying to pull them," Peter said. This wasn't even a question, because it seemed obvious to him. He felt sorry for the oxen dragging those great blocks of rock. "Nay," Yosef said. He lit a cigarette made of corn shuck, almost burning off the end of his nose, and drew deeply and contentedly. He always liked the young prince's company. "Nay, oxen aren't stupid. People only think them so because they are large and tame and helpful. Says more about the people than about the oxen, if you ask me. But leave that behind, leave that behind. If an ox can pull a block, he'll pull it. If he can't, why, he'll try twice and then stand with his head down. And he'll stand so even if a bad master whops his hide to ribbons. Oxen look stupid, but they ain't, not a bit."
"Then why do the cutters have to guess at the weight of the blocks they cut, if the ox knows what he can pull and what he can't?"
"'Tain't the blocks, it's the chains."
Yosef pointed to one of the oxen, which was dragging a block that looked to Peter almost as big as a small house. The ox's head was down, its eyes fixed patiently ahead, as its drover sat astride it and guided it with little taps of his stick. At the end of the double length of chain, the block moved slowly along, goring a furrow in the earth. It was so deep that a small child would need to work to climb out of it.
"If an ox can pull a block, he will. But an ox don't know nothing about chains or about the breaking strain."
"What's that?"
"Put a thing under enough of a tug and it'll snap," Yosef said. "If yonder chains were to snap, they'd fly around something terrible. You wouldn't want to be a witness to what can happen if a heavy chain lets go when it's under such a tug as those oxen can put on. It's apt to fly anywhere, backwards mostly. Apt to hit the drover and tear him apart, or cut the legs from under the beast itself."
Yosef took another drag at his makeshift cigarette and then tossed it in the dirt. He fixed Peter with a shrewd, friendly glare.
"Breaking strain," he said, "is a good thing for a prince to know about, Peter. Chains break if you put on enough of a tug, and people do, too. Keep it in mind."
He kept it in mind now, as he pulled at his first cable. How much of a tug was he putting on? 5 rol, at least. 10? Perhaps. But maybe that was only wishful thinking. He would say 8. No, 7. Better to make a mistake on the pessimistic side, if a mistake was to be made. If he miscalculated, well, the cobblestones in the Plaza of the Needle were very, very hard. He tugged harder still, the muscles on his arms now beginning to stand out a little. When the first cable finally snapped, Peter guessed he might be applying as much as 15 rol, almost 64 pounds, of tug. He was not unhappy with this result.
Later that night, he threw the broken cable out of his window where the men who cleaned the plaza of the Needle daily would sweep it up with the rest of the rubbish the following day. Peter's mother, seeing his interest in the dollhouse and the little furnishings inside, had taught him how to weave cables and braid them into tiny rugs. When we have not done a thing for a long period, we are apt to forget exactly how that thing was done. But Peter had nothing but time, and after some experimentation, the trick of braiding came back to him. Braiding was what his mother had called it, and so that was how he thought of it. But braiding was not really the right word for it. A braid, precisely speaking, is the hand-weaving of two cables. Wrapping, which is how rugs are made, is the hand-weaving of three or more cables. In wrapping, two cables are placed apart, but with their tops and bottoms even. The third is placed between them, but lower, so its end sticks out. This pattern is carried on as length after length is added. The result looks a little bit like Chinese finger pullers, or the braided rugs in your favorite grandmother's house. It took Peter 3 weeks to save enough threads to try this technique, and most of a fourth to remember exactly how the over and under pattern of wrapping had gone. But when he was done, he had a real rope. It was thin, and you would have thought him mad to entrust his weight to it, but it was much stronger than it looked. He found he could break it, but only by wrapping its ends firmly around his hands and pulling until the muscles bulged on his arms and chest and the cord stood out on his neck. Overhead in his sleeping chamber were a number of stout oak beams. He would have to test his weight from one of these when he had a rope long enough. If it snapped, he would have to start all over again. But such thoughts were useless, and Peter knew it, so he just got to work. Each thread he pulled was about 20 inches long, but Peter lost roughly 2 inches in the weaving and wrapping. It took him 3 months to make a rope of 3 strands, each strand consisting of 105 cotton threads, into a cable 3 feet long. One night, after he was sure all of the warders were drunk and at cards below, he tied this pigtail to a rope over one of the beams. When it had been looped over and tied in a slipknot, less than a foot and a half hung down. It looked woefully thin. Nevertheless, Peter seized it and hung from it, mouth tightened to a grim white line, expecting the threads to let go at any moment and spill him to the floor. But they held. They held. Hardly daring to believe it was happening, Peter hung there from a rope almost too thin to see. He hung there for almost a full minute, and then he stood on his bed to pull the slipknot free. His hands trembled as he did it, and he had to fumble at the knot twice because his eyes kept blurring with tears. He didn't believe his heart had been so full since reading Ben's tiny note. He had been keeping the rope under his mattress, but Peter realized this would not do much longer. The Needle was 340 feet high at the peak of its conical roof. His window was just about 300 feet above the cobblestones. He was 6 feet tall and believed he would dare to drop as much as 20 feet from the end of his rope. But even at best, he would eventually have to hide 270 feet of rope. He discovered a loose stone on the east side of the bedroom floor and cautiously pried it up. He was surprised and pleased to find a little space beneath. He couldn't see into it properly, so he reached in and felt around in the darkness, his whole body stiff and tense as he waited for something down there in the dark to crawl over his hand, or bite it. Nothing did, and he was just about to withdraw it when one of his fingers brushed something. Cold metal. Peter brought it out. It was, he saw, a heart-shaped locket on a fine chain. Both locket and chain looked to be made of gold. Nor did he think by its weight that the locket was false gold. After some poking and feeling, he found a delicate catch. He pushed it, and the locket sprang open. Inside were 2 pictures, one on each side. They were as fine as any of the tiny paintings in Sasha's dollhouse, even finer, perhaps. Peter stared at their faces with a boy's frank wonder. The man was very handsome, the woman very beautiful. There was a faint smile on the man's lips and a devil-may-care look in his eyes. The woman's eyes were grave and dark. Part of Peter's wonder came from the fact that this locket must be very old, judging by what he could make out of their dress, but only part of it. Most came from the fact that these 2 faces looked eerily familiar. He had seen them before. He closed the locket and looked on the back. He thought there were initials entwined there, but they were too flounced and curlicued for him to read. On impulse, he delved into the hold again.
This time he touched paper. The single sheet of foolscap he brought out was ancient and crumbling, but the writing was clear and the signature unmistakable. The name was Levin Valera, the infamous Black Duke of the Southern Barony. Valera, who might someday have been king, had instead spent the last 25 years of his life in the room at the top of the Needle for the murder of his wife. No wonder the pictures in the locket looked familiar. The man was Valera, the woman was Valera's murdered wife, Eleanor, about whose beauty ballads were still sung. The ink Valera had used was a strange rusty black, and the first line of his note chilled Peter's heart. The note entire chilled his heart, and not only because the similarity between Valera's position and his own seemed too great for coincidence.
To the finder of the note, I write with my own blood, drawn from a vein I have opened in my left forearm, my pen the shaft of a spoon, which I have sharpened long and long upon the stones of my bedchamber. Nearly a quarter of a century I have spent here in the sky. I came here a young man, and now am I old. The coughing spells and fever have come on me again, and this time I think I shall not survive. I did not kill my wife. Nay, though all the evidence say otherwise, I did not kill my wife. I did love her, and love her still, although her dear face has grown misty in my treacherous mind. I believe 'twas the king's magician who killed Eleanor, and arranged matters to see me put aside, for I stood in his way. It seems his plans have worked, and he has prospered. Yet I believe there are gods who punish wickedness in the end. His day shall come. And I have come to feel more and more strongly as my own death approaches that he shall be brought down by one who comes to this place of despair, one who finds and reads this letter written in my blood. If 'tis so, I cry out to you, avenge, avenge, avenge. Ignore me and my lost years if you must, but never, never, never ignore my dear Eleanor, murdered as she slept in her bed. It was not I who poisoned her wine. I write the name of the murderer here in blood. Flag! 'Twas flag! 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 Take the locket and show it to him the instant before you relieve this, the world, of its greatest scoundrel. Show him so that he may know in that instant that I have been a part of his downfall, even from beyond my unjust murderer's grave. Levin Valera.
Perhaps now you can understand the true source of Peter's chill. Perhaps not. Perhaps you will understand it better if I remind you that although he looked to be a man in a hale and hearty middle age, Flagg was really very old. Peter had read about the supposed crime of Levin Valera, yes, but the books in which he had read of it were histories, ancient histories. This crumbling, yellowed parchment first spoke of the king's magician, and then spoke of Flag by name. Spoke his name? Cried it. Shrieked it. In blood. But Valera's supposed crime had happened in the reign of Alan II, and Alan II had ruled Delane 450 years ago.
God, oh great God,
Peter whispered. He staggered back to his bed and sat down on it heavily, just before his knees would have unhinged and spilled him to the floor.
He's done it all before. He's done it all before, and in exactly the same way. But he did it over 4 centuries ago.
Peter's face was deadly white. His hair was standing on end. For the first time he realized that Flag, the king's magician, was in reality Flag, the monster, loose in Delane again now, serving a new king, serving his own young, confused, easily led brother. Peter at first entertained giddy thoughts of promising Beeson another bribe to take the locket and the crumbling sheet of foolscap to Anders Pena.
In his initial flush of excitement, it seemed to him that this note must point the finger of guilt at Flagg and set him, Peter, free. A little reflection convinced him that while that might happen in a storybook, it would not happen in real life. Pena would laugh and call it a forgery. And if he took it seriously, that might mean the end of both the Judge General and the imprisoned prince. Peter's ears were sharp, and he listened closely to the gossip of the mead houses and the wine shops as it was passed back and forth between Beeson and the lesser warders. He had heard of the farmer's tax increase, had heard the bitter joke which suggested that Thomas the Lightbringer should be renamed Thomas the Taxbringer. He had even heard that some few daring wags had renamed his brother Foggy Tom the Constantly Bombed. The headsman's axe had swung with the regularity of a clock's pendulum since Thomas had ascended Delane's throne. Only this clock called out, treason, sedition, treason, sedition, treason, sedition, with a regularity that would have been monotonous had it not been so frightening. By now Peter had begun to suspect Flagg's goal, to bring the ordered monarchy of Delane to an utter smash. Showing the locket and the note would only get him laughed at or cause Pena to take some sort of action, and that would undoubtedly get them both killed. In the end, Peter put the locket and fool's cap back where they had come from, and with them he put the little 3-foot pigtail it had taken him a month to weave. On the whole, he did not feel too bitter about the evening's work. The rope had held, and the finding of the locket and fool's cap after more than 400 years proved at least one thing. The hiding place was not apt to be discovered. Still, he had much food for thought, and he lay long awake that night. When he slept, he seemed to hear Levin Valera's dry, stony voice whispering in one ear, "Avenge! Avenge! Avenge!"
Seventy-four. Time. Yes, time. Peter spent a great deal of time at the top of the needle. His beard grew long, save for where that white scar streaked his cheek like a lightning bolt. He saw many changes from his window as it grew. He heard of more terrible changes yet. The headsman's pendulum had not slowed down but actually speeded up. Treason, sedition, treason, sedition, it sang, and sometimes half a dozen heads rolled in the course of but a single day. During Peter's third year of imprisonment, the year in which Peter was first able to do 30 chin-ups in a single effort from his bedchamber's central beam, Pena resigned his post as Judge General in disgust. It was the talk of the mead houses and wine shops for a week, and the talk of Peter's keepers for a week and a day. The warders believed that Flagg would have Pena jailed almost before the heat of the old man's bum had left the judge's bench, and that soon after the citizens of Delane would find out once and for all if there was blood or ice water in the Judge General's veins. But when Pena remained free, the talk died down. Peter was glad Pena had not been arrested. He bore him no ill will, in spite of Pena's willingness to believe that he had murdered his father, and he knew that the arrangement of the evidence had been Flagg's doing. Also during Peter's third year in the needle, Dennis's good old da, Brandon, died. His passing was simple but dignified. He had finished his day's work in spite of a terrible pain in his chest and side and came slowly home. He sat down in a little living room, hoping the pain would pass. Instead, it grew worse. He called his wife and son to his side, kissed them both, and asked if he might have a glass of bundle gin. This was provided. He drank it off, kissed his wife again, and then sent her from the room. "You must serve your master well now, Dennis," he said. "Ye're a man now with a man's task set before you."
"I'll serve the king as well as I may, da," Dennis said, although the thought of taking over his father's responsibilities terrified him. His good, homely face was shiny with tears. For the last 3 years, Brandon and Dennis had buttled for Thomas, and Dennis's responsibilities had been much the same as before, with Peter, but it had never been the same somehow, never even close to the same.
"Thomas, I..." Brandon said, and then whispered, "But if the time comes to do your first master a service, Dennis, you mustn't hesitate. I have never—"
At that moment, Brandon clutched the left side of his chest, stiffened, and died. He died where he would have wanted to die, in his own chair in front of his own fire. In Peter's fourth year of imprisonment, his rope below the stones growing steadily longer and longer, the Stad family disappeared. The throne possessed itself of what little there remained of their lands, as it had done when other noble families disappeared, and as Thomas's reign progressed, there were more and more disappearances. The Stads were only one item of Mead House gossip in a busy week that included four beheadings, an increased levy against shopkeepers, and the imprisonment of an old woman who had for 3 days walked back and forth in front of the palace, screaming that her grandson had been taken and tortured for speaking against the previous year's cattle levies. But when Peter heard the Stad name in the warder's conversation, his heart had stopped for a moment. The chain of events leading to the disappearance of the Stads was one familiar to everyone in Delane by now. The tick-tocking pendulum of the headsman's axe had thinned the numbers of the nobility terribly. Many of these nobles died because their families had served the kingdom for hundreds or thousands of years, and they could not believe such an unjust fate would or could fall on them. Others, seeing bloody handwriting on the wall, fled. The Stads were among these. And the whispering began. Tales were told behind cupped hands, tales suggesting that these nobles had not simply scattered to the four winds, but had gathered together somewhere, perhaps in the deep woods at the northern end of the kingdom, to plan an overthrow of the throne. These stories passed to Peter like the wind through his window, the drafts beneath his door. They were dreams of a wider world. Mostly he worked on his rope. During the first year, the rope grew longer by 18 inches every 3 weeks. At the end of that year, he had a slim cable that was 25 feet long, a cable that was, theoretically at least, strong enough to bear his weight. But there was a difference between dangling from a beam in his bedroom and dangling above a drop of 300 feet, and Peter knew it. He was, quite literally, staking his life on that slim cord. And 25 feet a year was perhaps not enough. It would take more than 8 years before he could even try, and the rumblings he heard at second hand had grown loud enough to be disturbing. Above all else, the kingdom must endure. There must be no revolt, no chaos. Wrongs must be put right, but by law, not by bows and slings and maces and clubs. Thomas, Levin Valera, Roland, he himself, even Flag, paled into insignificance next to that. There must be law. How Anders Pena, growing old and bitter by his fire, would have loved him for that. Peter determined that he must make his effort to escape as soon as possible. Accordingly, he made long calculations, doing the figures in his head so as to leave no trace. He did them again and again and again, proving to himself that he had made no mistake. In his second year in the needle, he began to pluck 10 threads from each napkin. In his third year, 15. In his fourth year, 20. The rope grew. 58 feet long after the second year, 104 after the third, 160 after the fourth. The rope at that time would still have fetched up 140 feet from the ground. During his last year, Peter began to take 30 threads from each napkin, and for the first time his robberies showed clearly. Each napkin looked frayed on all four sides as if mice had been at it. Peter waited in agony for his thefts to be discovered. But they were not discovered, then or ever. There was not so much as a question ever raised. Peter had spent endless nights, or so they seemed to him, wondering and worrying when Flag would hear some wrong thing, some wrong note, and so get wind of what he was up to. He would send some underling, Peter supposed, and the questions would begin. Peter had thought things out with agonizing care, and he had made only one wrong assumption, but that one led to a second, as wrong assumptions so often do, and that second was a dilly. He had assumed that there was some finite number of napkins, perhaps 1,000 or so in all, and that they were being used over and over again. His thinking on the subject of the napkin supply never went much further than that. Dennis could have told him differently and saved him perhaps 2 years of work, but Dennis was never asked. The truth was simple but staggering. Peter's napkins were not coming from a supply of 1,000, or 2,000, or 20,000. There were nearly 500,000 of these old, musty napkins in all. On one of the deep levels below the castle was a storeroom as big as a ballroom, and it was filled with napkins. Napkins. Nothing but napkins. They smelled musty to Peter, and that wasn't surprising. Most of them, coincidentally or not, dated from a time not long after the imprisonment and death of Levin Valera, and the existence of all those napkins, coincidentally or not, was, indirectly at least, the work of Flagg. In a queer sort of way, he had created them. Those had been dark times indeed for Delane. The chaos Flagg so earnestly wished had almost come upon the land. Valera had been removed. Mad King Alan had ascended the throne in his place. If he had lived another 10 years, the kingdom surely would have drowned in blood. But Alan was struck down by lightning while playing cubits on the back lawn in the pouring rain one day. As I told you, he was mad. It was lightning, some said, sent by the gods themselves. He was followed by his niece, Kyla, who became known as Kyla the Good, and from Kyla the line of succession had run straight and true down through the generations to Roland and the brothers to whose tale you have been listening. It was Kyla, the good queen, who brought the land out of its darkness and poverty. She had nearly bankrupted the royal treasury to do it, but she knew that currency, hard currency, is the life's blood of a kingdom. Much of Delane's hard currency had been drained away during the wild, weird reign of Alan II, a king who had sometimes drunk blood from the notched ears of his servants, and who had insisted that he could fly, a king more interested in magic and necromancy than profit and loss and the welfare of his people. Kyla knew it would take a massive flow of both love and guilders to set the wrongs of Alan's reign right, and she began by trying to put every able-bodied person in Delane back to work, from eldest to youngest. Many of the older citizens of the castle keep had been set to making napkins, not because napkins were needed. I think I have already told you how most of Delane's royalty and nobility felt about them, but because work was needed. These were hands that had been idle for 20 years or more in some cases, and they worked with a will, weaving on looms exactly like the one in Sasha's dollhouse, except in the matter of size, of course. For 10 years, these old people, over 1,000 of them, made napkins and drew hard coin from Kyla's treasury for their work. For 10 years, people only slightly younger and a little more able to get about had taken them down to the cool, dry storeroom below the castle. Peter had noticed that some of the napkins brought to him were moth-eaten as well as musty-smelling. The wonder, although he didn't know it, was that so many of them were still in such fine condition. Dennis could have told him that the napkins were brought, used once, removed, minus the few threads Peter plucked from each, and then simply thrown away. After all, why not? There were enough of them, all told, to last 500 princes 500 years, and longer. If Anders Pena had not been a merciful man as well as a hard one, there really might have been a finite number of napkins, but he knew how badly that nameless woman in the rocking chair needed the work and the pittance it brought in. Kyla the Good had known the same in her time, and so he kept her on as he continued to see that Beeson's guilders went on flowing after the Stads were forced to flee. She became a fixture outside the room of the napkins, that old woman with her needle for unmaking rather than making. There she sat in her rocker, year after year, removing tens of thousands of royal crests, and so it was really not surprising that no word of Peter's petty thievery ever reached Flagg's ears. So you see that, except for that one mistaken assumption and that one unasked question, Peter could have gotten about his work much faster. It did sometimes seem to him that the napkins were not shrinking as rapidly as they ought to have done, but it never occurred to him to question his basic, if vague, idea that the napkins he used were being regularly returned to him. If he had asked himself that one simple question. But perhaps in the end all things worked for the best. Or perhaps not. That is another thing you must decide for yourself. Eventually Dennis got over his fright of being Thomas's butler. After all, Thomas ignored him almost completely, except to sometimes berate him for forgetting to put out his shoes. Usually Thomas himself had left his shoes somewhere else, then forgotten where, or to insist Dennis have a glass of wine with him. The wine always made Dennis feel sick to his stomach, although he had come to enjoy a wee drop of bundle gin in the evenings. He drank it nonetheless. He did not need his good old da around to tell him one did not refuse to drink with the king when asked. And sometimes, Usually when he was drunk, Thomas would forbid Dennis to go home but insist that he spend the night in Thomas's apartments instead. Dennis supposed, and rightly, that these were nights on which Thomas simply felt too lonely to bear his own solitary company. He would give long, besotted, rambling sermons on how difficult it was to be king, how he was trying to do the best job he could and be fair, and how everyone hated him for some reason or other just the same. Thomas often wept during these sermons, or laughed wildly at nothing, but usually he just fell asleep halfway through some mangled defense of one tax or another. Sometimes he staggered off to his bed and Dennis could sleep on the couch. More often, Thomas fell asleep, or passed out, on the couch and Dennis made his uncomfortable bed on the cooling hearth. It was perhaps the strangest existence any king's butler had ever known, but, of course, it seemed normal enough to Dennis because it was all he had ever known. Thomas mostly ignoring him was one thing. Flagg ignoring him was another, even more important thing. Flagg had, in fact, entirely dismissed Dennis's part in his scheme to send Peter to the Needle. Dennis had been no more than a tool to him, a tool which had served its purpose and could be put aside. If he had thought of Dennis, it would have seemed to him that the tool had been well rewarded. Dennis was the king's butler, after all. But on an early winter's night in the year when Peter was 21 and Thomas 16, a night when Peter's thin rope was finally nearing completion, Dennis saw something which changed everything, and it is with the thing Dennis saw that cold night that I must begin to narrate the final events in my tale. 77. It was a night much like those during the terrible time just before and after Roland's death. The wind shrieked out of a black sky and moaned in the alleys of Delane. Frost lay thick in the pastures of the inner baronies and on the cobbles of the castle city. At first, a three-quarters moon chased in and out of the rushing clouds, but by midnight the clouds had thickened enough to obscure the moon completely, and by 2 in the morning, when Thomas awoke Dennis by rattling the latch of the door between his sitting room and the corridor outside, it had begun to snow. Dennis heard the rattling and sat up, grimacing at the stiffness in his back and the pins and needles in his legs. Tonight, Thomas had fallen asleep on the couch instead of lurching his way to bed, so it had been the hearth for the young butler. Now the fire was almost out. The side of him which had been lying closer to it felt baked, the other side of him felt frozen. He looked toward the rattling sound, and for a moment terror froze in his heart and vitals. For that one moment he thought there was a ghost at the door, and he almost screamed. Then he saw it was only Thomas in his white nightshirt.
My lord king?
Thomas took no notice. His eyes were open, but they were not looking at the latch. They were wide and dreaming, and they looked straight ahead at nothing. Dennis suddenly guessed that the young king was sleepwalking. Even as Dennis decided this, Thomas seemed to realize that the reason the latch wouldn't work was that the bolt was still on. He drew it and then passed out into the hall, looking more ghost-like than ever in the guttering light of the corridor sconces. There was a swirl of nightshirt hem, and then he was gone on bare feet. Dennis sat stock still on the hearth for a moment, cross-legged, his pins and needles forgotten, his heart thumping. Outside, the wind hurled snow against the diamond-shaped panes of the sitting-room window and uttered a long, banshee howl. What should he do? There was only one thing, of course. The young king was his master. He must follow. Perhaps it was the wild night which had brought Roland so vividly to Thomas's mind, but not necessarily. In fact, Thomas thought of his father a great deal. Guilt is like a sore, endlessly fascinating, and the guilty party feels compelled to examine it and pick at it so that it never really heals. Thomas had drunk far less than usual, but strangely had seemed drunker than ever to Dennis. His sentences had been broken and garbled, his eyes wide and staring, showing too much of the whites. This was, to a large extent, because Flagg was gone. There had been rumors that the renegade nobility, Stads among them, had been seen gathered together in the far forests at the northern reaches of the kingdom. Flagg had led a regiment of tough, battle-hardened soldiers in search of them. Thomas was always more skittish when Flagg was gone. He knew it was because he had come to depend completely on the dark magician, but he had come to depend on Flagg in ways he did not fully understand. Too much wine was no longer Thomas's only vice. Sleep is often denied to those with secrets, and Thomas was afflicted with severe insomnia. Without knowing it, he had become addicted to Flagg's sleeping potions. Flagg had left a supply of the drug with Thomas when he led the soldiers north, but Flagg had expected to be gone only 3 days, 4 at the most. For the last 3 days, Thomas had slept badly or not at all. He felt strange, never quite awake, never quite asleep. Thoughts of his father haunted him. He seemed to hear his father's voice in the wind, crying out, "Why do you stare at me? Why do you stare at me so?" Visions of wine, visions of Flagg's darkly cheerful face, visions of his father's hair catching fire, these things drove sleep away and left him wide-eyed in the long watches of the night while the rest of the castle slept. When Flagg had still not returned on the 8th night, he and his soldiers were even then camped 50 miles from the castle, and Flagg was in a foul mood. The only trace of the nobles they found had been frozen hoofprints that might have been days or weeks old. Thomas sent for Dennis. It was later that night, that 8th night, that Thomas arose from his couch and began to walk. So, Dennis followed his lord and master the king down those long, drafty stone corridors, and if you have come along this far, I think you must know where Thomas the Lightbringer finished up. Late stormy night had passed into early stormy morning. No one was abroad in the corridors. At least, Dennis saw no one. If anyone had been abroad, he or she might well have fled in the other direction, perhaps screaming, believing he or she had seen two ghosts walking, the one leading in a long white nightshirt that could easily have been mistaken for a shroud, the other following in a plain jerkin, but with bare feet and a face pale enough to have been mistaken for the face of a corpse. Yes, I believe anyone who saw them would have fled and told long prayers before sleeping, and even many prayers might not have kept the nightmares at bay. Thomas stopped in the middle of a corridor that Dennis had seldom been down, and he opened a recessed door which Dennis had never really noticed at all. The boy king stepped into another corridor. No chambermaid passed them with an armload of sheets, as one had once passed Thomas and Flagg, when Flagg had brought the prince this way some years before. All good chambermaids were long since in their beds, and part way down it, Thomas stopped so suddenly that Dennis almost ran into him. Thomas looked around, as if to see if he had been followed, and his dreaming eyes passed directly over Dennis. Dennis's skin crawled, and it was all he could do to keep from crying out. The sconces in this almost forgotten hallway guttered and stank foully of das oil. The light was faint and gruesome. The young butler could feel his hair trying to clump up and push out in spikes as those empty eyes like dead lamps lit only by the moon, passed over him. He was there, standing right there, but Thomas did not see him. To Thomas, his butler was dim. "Oh, I must run," part of Dennis's mind whispered distractedly, but inside his head, that distracted little whisper was like a scream. "Oh, I must run. He has died. He has died in his sleep, and I am following a walking corpse." But then he heard the voice of his Da, his own dear dead Da, whispering, "If the time ever comes to do your first master a service, Dennis, you mustn't hesitate." A voice deeper than either told him that the time for that service had come, and Dennis, a lowly servant boy who had changed a kingdom once by discovering a burning mouse, perhaps changed it again by holding his place in spite of the terror which froze his bones and pushed his heart into his throat. In a strange, deep voice that was nothing at all like his usual voice, but to Dennis that voice sounded weirdly familiar, Thomas said,
"Fourth stone up from the one at the bottom with the chip in it. Press it. Quick."
The habit of obedience was so ingrained in Dennis that he had actually begun to move forward before realizing that Thomas, in his dream, had commanded himself in the voice of another. Thomas pushed the stone before Dennis could move more than a single step. It slid in perhaps 3 inches. There was a click. Dennis's jaw dropped as part of the wall swung inward. Thomas pushed it farther, and Dennis saw there was a huge secret door here. Secret doors made him think of secret panels, and secret panels made him think of burning mice. Again he felt an urge to run, and fought it down. Thomas went in. For a moment he was only a glimmering nightshirt in the dark, a nightshirt with no one inside it. Then the stone wall closed again. The illusion was perfect. Dennis stood there, shifting from one cold bare foot to the other cold bare foot. What should he do now? Again it was his Da's voice he seemed to hear, impatient now, brooking no refusal.
"Follow, you paltry boy. Follow and be quick. This is the moment. Follow."
"But Da, the dark."
He seemed to feel a stinging slap, and Dennis thought hysterically,
"Even when you're dead, you got a strong right hand, Da. All right, I'm going."
He counted up four from the chipped stone and pushed. The door swung about 4 inches inward on darkness. There was a tiny, clittering sound in the awesome silence of the corridor, a sound like mice made of stone. After a moment, Dennis realized that sound was his own teeth chattering together.
"Oh, Da, I'm so scared,"
he mourned, and then followed King Thomas into the darkness. '79. 50 miles away, rolled into 5 blankets against the bitter cold and the roaring wind, Flag cried out in his sleep at the precise moment Dennis followed the king into the secret passageway. On a knoll not far distant, wolves howled in unison with that cry. The soldier sleeping nearest Flag on the left died instantly of a heart attack, dreaming that a great lion had come to gobble him up. The soldier sleeping on Flag's right woke up in the morning to discover he was blind. Worlds sometimes shudder and turn inside their axes, and this was such a time. Flag felt it, but did not grasp it. The salvation of all that is good is only this. At times of great import, evil beings sometimes fall strangely blind. When the king's magician awoke in the morning, he knew that he had had a bad dream, probably from his own long-forgotten past, but he did not remember what it had been. 80. The darkness inside the secret passage was utter and complete, the air still and dry. In it, coming from somewhere ahead, Dennis heard a terrible, desolate sound. The king was weeping. At that sound, some of Dennis's fear left him. He felt a great wonder, and a great pity for Thomas, who always seemed so unhappy and who had grown fat and pimply as king. Often he was pallid and shaky-handed from too much wine the night before, and his breath was usually bad. Already Thomas's legs were beginning to bow, and unless Flag was with him, he had a tendency to walk with his head down and his hair hanging in his face. Dennis felt his way forward, his hands held out in front of him. The sound of weeping grew closer in the dark, and then, suddenly, the dark was no longer complete. He heard a faint sliding noise, and then he could see Thomas faintly. He was standing at the end of the corridor, and faint amber light was coming in from 2 small holes in the dark. To Dennis, those holes looked strangely like floating eyes. Just as Dennis began to believe that he would be all right, that he would probably survive this strange night walk, Thomas shrieked. He shrieked so loudly it seemed that his vocal cords must split open. The strength ran out of Dennis's legs and he fell to his knees. Hands clapped over his mouth to stop his own screams, and now it seemed to him that this secret way was filled with ghosts, ghosts like strange flapping bats that might at any moment snare themselves in his hair. Oh, yes, the place seemed filled with the unquiet dead to Dennis, and perhaps it was. Perhaps it was. He almost swooned. Almost. But not quite. Somewhere below him, he heard barking dogs and realized they were above the old king's kennels. The few of Roland's dogs, still alive, had never been moved outside again. They were the only living beings, besides Dennis himself, that had heard those wild shrieks. But the dogs were real, not ghosts, and Dennis held on to that thought the way a drowning man might hold on to a floating mast. A moment or two later, he realized that Thomas was not just shrieking. He was crying out words. At first, Dennis could make out only a single phrase, howled out again and again.
"Don't drink the wine,"
Don't drink the wine. Don't drink the wine.
Three nights later, a light knock came at the closed sitting-room door of a farm in one of the inner baronies,